After so many years in hospital, the sight of so many books made me feel that one has to be a fearless pilgrim to arrive safely at the library. I went out and spoke to the librarian. "May I go inside and look at the books?" She smiled. "Certainly." I walked up the ramp and stood in the van, trying to decide where to begin my inspection of the concealed words whose bones were moulded together by men to make either an awesome vision of truth that would guard any door of the mind, or a creature that would stand for a while deceptively whole, then collapse, scattering across the threshold the dried dead bones that did not even burst into flame at the friction of one with the other. I was standing gazing and dreaming when suddenly the chaplain appeared in the doorway of the van. He knew me. He had seen me in World Two, in the park and the yard. He spread his hands in quick movement, as if to bear the precious book safely to him. "Come out of there," he said sharply to me. "Oh, please let me look at them. I won't touch any, I promise." The chaplain looked more horrified. "No patient is allowed in there. No patient is allowed in the van. Come out this instant." He looked about him as if searching for someone to deal with me in a way that he knew mental patients are dealt with if they become obstinate. I walked out of the van. After the excitement of seeing the books and then being denied a chance to look at them by someone who, curiously lacking in understanding for a chaplain, had said, making the old distinction between patients and people, "No patient is allowed," I was almost in tears. There I had been standing, drearily drying cups and thinking perhaps about dinner or mail or the wire dormitory where I was still spent the night, when suddenly a library had appeared just outside the window, and a tweedy fairy godmother had not denied my request to look inside, but the villain arrived and turned me away because I had not the status necessary for people who view shelves of books. I was a patient and could not be trusted. I was a child and would not grasp the content, the essential meaning of the books. He sees the land of meaning and one path to it, and the so-called normal people travelling swiftly and in comfort to the land. He does not include the shipwrecked people who arrive by devious, lonely routes, and the many who dwell in the land in the beginning. I returned to the tea room and put away the last cups, hung the tea towel to dry, switched off the zip heater, replaced the keys, carefully observing the routine in a melodramatic way, as if someone had died and I had announced heroically that I would keep going. I tried not to cry. The chaplain had spoken to me as if I suffered from a disease that would infect the books. He was right. I returned to the ward and went to the day room and stayed surveying the usual dismal scene, the lonely, muddled old ladies and the bewildered new patients trying to get used to the idea of being in Cliffhaven and being locked up, and the fires being locked and the windows opening only 6 inches, and the nurses commanding day room ladies, bed ladies, rise ladies. And then a nurse called me. "Sister wants you." What have I done? I was being transferred to Ward 2. Were they taking me away to shave my head for an operation, in spite of Dr. Portman? "Sister wants you. Hurry." Sister Honey was standing behind the serving table, setting the roast on its board, ready for the matron to carve. She told me that Dr. Portman had rung up and wanted me to go immediately to his office. So Dr. Portman had changed his mind. He had decided they would bore 2 holes in the side of my head for my unsuitable personality to fly out like a migrating bird to another country and never return, not even when spring came and the cherry blossom opened and the spinely wild plum showed white along the paddock fences. I was afraid and went alone down the front of the hospital and was standing in the wide polished hall being gazed at by the heavily featured brown and maroon portraits of past administrators and philanthropists and village councillors when Dr. Portman came in the front door and hurried towards me. He was excited. His cheeks were flecked with red. "Come out to the library van, Istina," he urged. We went to the van. He walked up the ramp and beckoned me to follow. I entered loyally. And then he explained that about 60 books had to be chosen for the hospital library, and would I kindly help him choose them? There was no sign of the chaplain. I wonder what he, the villain, would have said if he had seen me entertained by the tubby, loud-voiced, intelligent, intuitive prince in the Forbidden Castle. Both formality and dinner forgotten, we sat on the floor of the little library, choosing. Sometimes Dr. Portman read passages aloud and turned his own memories with their dark side to face the light, and it was late afternoon when, with a headache of happiness, I returned to the ward, and from that day I felt in myself a reserve of warmth from which I could help myself like coal from the cellar on a winter's day. If the snow came, or if the frost fell in the night to blacken the flowers and wither the new fruit. I began to go out walking more often by myself, and once I went down to the village store, which was not out of bounds, and brought myself a jar of peanut butter. And often I remembered the patients of Ward 2, and on my way to the canteen I passed the dirty day room and the clean day room, and Brenda, in her striped dress, tottered to the window to say hello. "Hello, Mr. Stina Mavitt," she pouted and then smiled, as if she were in the clean day room, she would play a piece of music to me, if Mr. Frederick Barnes allowed her. And Carol would squat down by the window and tell me the latest news of her engagement and the further details she had worked out for the wedding, which was not, after all, to be with the pig boy or with any of Hillary's friends, but with a stranger. "Some enchanted evening you may see a stranger." "Strangers are best," said Carol. "Best for marrying. Strangers or film stars. And I'm clined for the man on the radio, Roy." Roy was the announcer who controlled the Sunday request programmes, patronised by Hillary and Carol. Their latest favourite was still "On Top of Old Smoky or Covered in Snow. I lost my true lover through courting so slow." Where once again life seemed to depend on a swifter warmth than most people. Even lovers are prepared to give. One can only assume that the loved one lies frozen to death on the top of Old Smoky. While I would be talking to Carol, Maudie liked to come to the window to have her say, for one of her duties as guard was that of a commentator on the affairs of Ward 2. "Istina Mavitt is standing by the window. Istina Mavitt is talking to Carol. Down you go, Istina Mavitt." Looking through the window, I felt depressed and hopeless at the sameness of everything. Living is so much like one of those childhood games where you keep shutting your eyes and opening them, expect to find everything changed, a new city with glass towers, a table laden for a feast, a kindly forest where the trees no longer strike blows or twist themselves into fearful shapes. In Ward 2 it was still the same. First tea ladies, lavatory ladies, bed and the rushing under the cut-out daisy stars and the cold sky to the cheerless brick building and the urine-saturated floors and straw-smelling rooms and the long evening and night. Cannot one exercise one's will as a living hammer to force the shape of change? I could not stop thinking of the people of Ward 2. Brenda, Zoe, Mona, Maudie, the total alienation of Esme. Her sitting alone in the puddled corner, her striped dress over her head, no pants on, her feet bare, her black eyes gleaming in her pale face through the slits in the front of her dress, the animal cries, the bird speech, and the hidden people of Ward 1. The children, the old ladies, the idiots, the withered yet ageless Mongols with their dumpy bodies and their faithful ways, their neat trotting to and fro on simple errands, their absorbed gazing at what they and others will never comprehend. And then the patients who, when they are undressed at night, are found to have their fingers clenched tightly over something which they refuse to surrender, as if they said, You can have the blue striped dress and the flannelette pants, bunchy, reaching to the knee, and the grey woollen ward stockings and the V-necked striped garment known in official records as a chemise. But these you cannot have. The stalks of grass which I picked for myself in the park, the piece of silver paper from somebody's chocolate, the ball of hair that I found on the floor of the bathroom, my treasures that give meaning to my long day of sitting crouched, hands over my knees, staring from the yellowed patch of park grass to the sun in the sky, Lord Landless in the King's White Hall.